Blog Talk Radio.
Are black people free in America, or are we volunteered slaves? We'll talk about that in a few minutes. What do you think? Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination, freedom, and sovereignty. Peace, family. Welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is where we have sobering conversation about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. To join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number one on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.usliftingus.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. You will then be on the Blog Talk Radio site. If you want to get reminders from Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, just click on the follow button. My name is Ann. Joining me for this evening's discussion is Brother Ankti, who, like me, is a member of Hulu. Peace, Brother Ankti. How are you doing tonight?
Peace, Sister Q. I'm doing excellent. Good to hear your voice. Good to be with you tonight. I'm reminded that we find ourselves in a time of deep crisis. And what I find exciting about that is the Chinese character for crisis means dangerous opportunity. So while there's danger on every side, there are exciting opportunities in front of us if we dare to win. So I'm excited to be here and looking forward to this evening's conversation.
I'm looking forward to it as well. So tell me what you – how did you come to tonight? Because, you know, we're all free, aren't we? I mean, that's what we all think.
Well, I think, Sister Q, I think what we're caught up in the illusion of freedom. I think Professor Ezra Aharon has a good label for it. He calls it chattel freedom, and I like that because it evokes the understanding of our history as chattel slaves. And yet we are no longer shackled by the neck and the hands and the ankles, but the chattel stigma still is attached to us, and the form of slavery has changed. And that's what we want to talk about tonight. We need to wake up to the reality that what we are calling freedom is, in fact, a more sophisticated form of enslavement. And I was just thinking about that, and I said, let's see if we can have that conversation tonight, because the opportunity for us is that we are poised and positioned to be the leaders in the movement towards an entire economic, a new economic model. And if we understand the mechanism and what we're building in Ulu, we can jailbreak this madness and create genuine opportunities for self-determination and sovereignty for ourselves and for Africans all around the globe.
That's our plan. Or we should say that's our intention. We're doing more
Absolutely.
Than planning. We're intending and working toward that. Absolutely. So you say we're not free, but you know.
Let's put this in historical context, so it'll make a little more sense, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
In from as early as 1526 up until 1865, black uh-huh. people in North America were held captive in a system of involuntary slavery or chattel slavery.
Uh-huh.
Chattel slavery was not only a form of physical enslavement, but it was also a form of dehumanization. In other words, not only were we physically in bondage, but we were stripped of all of our human characteristics, and we were reduced to portable property. In other words, black enslaved Africans in North America were the portable personal property of the white slave-owning class. Now, that's
okay.
deep. That's the form of slavery that the planet had not seen up until then and
uh-huh.
still has not seen. So we were forced at gunpoint to work for free from can't see in the morning until can't see at night. And that was like 339 years of that. We all know
okay.
we were whipped and beaten and raped and killed, made to plant and harvest cotton, sugar, tobacco, the products that made America rich and laid
uh-huh.
the economic foundation that enabled America to become the wealthiest country in the world. And so in 1865, the South loses the Civil War. And in December of 1865, if my dates are correct, the 13th Amendment is ratified that abolishes slavery in the United States with the exception of convicted criminals. Now, They slipped that clause in there for a very good reason. They realized that the South now had lost its labor supply, and the Southern economy had ground to a halt. It was in shambles. And so the question was, how are we going to get this Southern economy back up and running now that these formerly enslaved Africans are free? And so there was basically three strategies to solve the problem of the enslaved Africans now being free. The first strategy was sharecropping. And what that meant was, and a whole set of laws were passed from 1865 through 1868, 1869, called Black Codes. And these laws defined what these formerly enslaved Africans could do, what kind of jobs they could hold, what kind of mobility they would have on the land. And what they wound up doing was re-enslaving the Africans by saying that they had to work for, they had to be employed. And if they couldn't show papers showing that they were employed, they were considered vagrants, and that was a crime for which they could be locked up. So the first strategy was to put them back on the land, harvesting crops, whether we're talking cotton, whether we're talking sugar, whether we're talking apples, whatever the agricultural work was, these now freed Africans would do the work, and the catch was, okay, you're free, and since you are on my land, I'm going to let you rent the house that you're in, and it wasn't a house, it was a shack. I'm going to provide you food and tools and seeds and everything necessary. You're going to till the land. You're going to grow the crop. You're going to harvest the crop. If we harvest it and sell it, then we will settle up, right? After the planting season is over and the crops get taken to market and they get sold, then the owner comes back to these tenant farmers who've been on his land raising the crops. They begin to settle up. Okay, John and Barry, here's what we made off of the crops. Now, you were on the land for 9 months, and so the rent for that 9 months is X amount. The food that you ate is X amount. The amount of seed is X amount. The tools that you use, X amount. And what would happen is at the end of the settling up period, oftentimes the formerly enslaved Africans found up that not only did they not make any money, but they still owed the landowner, they owed him money. They stayed in debt season after season after season after season. So that's a thumbnail sketch of sharecropping. The second strategy that they used was mass incarceration. In other words, if you couldn't show that you had employment from somebody, you were considered a vagrant, and the sheriff or his deputies could lock you up for vagrancy. You'd go before the judge. You'd be convicted of being a vagrant. Now you are a criminal with a conviction, and so they throw you in jail, and now you become convict leased labor. So now you're back in slavery, but this time it's legal, and Michelle Alexander does a tremendous amount of help for us in her book, The New Jim Crow. I'm sure many of our listeners have read that. But the whole mass incarceration system was a way of locking up black folks and tying them back onto the land in a slave status so that their labor could be exploited again, right? The third strategy, and this is what had me thinking about tonight's topic, Sister Q, was the system wage or hourly labor, including salaried workers. Now, now keep in mind, as the Civil War is ending, we're going into Reconstruction. It's also the expansion of industrialization coming out of Europe into the United States. The steel industry is beginning to get underway in the United States, and the whole factory system, whether we're making metal tools and implements, whether it's the textile work, you know, we're now taking the cotton and we're producing, turning that into fabric. The factory system required workers. And the story we were given was that we were now in a position to sell our labor to the factory owners for a wage, and that's how we got paid on a weekly basis. So we went to work for $1 an hour or $2 an hour, whatever it was. And and that is the system that you and I and others have grown up in, if we think about it. I remember as going up through elementary and high school, the mantra that was given to us was get a good education, go to college, and get a good job with benefits, right? That was the goal of going to college, so that you could qualify and get you a good paying job when you got out of college. And I had an experience in college. I went to Syracuse, and so I'm there thinking that I'm equipping myself so that when I leave there with degree in hand, I'll be a candidate for a quote-unquote good-paying job. What I ran into, though, was the white students that were there, their parents were running factories and businesses. And they weren't there to prepare themselves for a good job. They were there to turn, to go back home and run the family business, or to show mom and dad how to run the business even better. They had a totally different mindset, and so what we have to wake up from as a people is to understand that this so-called good job, this hourly wage paying position that we have is in fact a form of slavery. Now, somebody that may upset somebody. Let me pause there. You may want to ask me a question or two, but I really want to unpack that because I think that's the crux of why we can't make any progress in America, is because we are thinking that as long as you have a good-paying job, that we've arrived, that we're free. And, I mean, you know, if you've got enough money, you can get on an airplane, you can take a cruise, you can go to Europe, you can go to Africa, you can buy a house, you can buy cars, you can live large. And so, you know, how dare I say that that we're not free?
But, you know, Brother Ankti, when you were talking about the conditions of slavery, you said where you work from can't see in the morning to can't see at night. How many people get up before dawn or at dawn, can't see, to get dressed, get ready to go to work, work all day, and it's dark when they come home? That's the same thing.
Absolutely.
And then you were talking about the sharecropping, and they tell you how much you owe at the end of the season or whatever, and you never get ahead. You wind up owing something at the end of the year, right? So you have to keep working. But basically, in a way, that's what we do now. We have credit cards, though. So it's not like, you know, so what we can't, what our salaries don't cover, we put on the credit card so that we are in debt and we have to stay basically on the on the plantation. That's why, I guess that's why people call it a plantation. That just came to me. But mm-hmm. we, as you said, we haven't really gone anywhere or done anything. We're still where we were. We're not building for ourselves. We're putting all of our energies into building up somebody else's economy, and at the end of the day or at the end of the year, we may or may not have a little bit to show for ourselves. Am I just reading too much? You know, is my imagination going off and I'm just putting stuff in where it doesn't belong?
No, that's precisely the point. What we didn't understand, Sister Q, or at least I didn't understand. Maybe everybody else understood it, and I was just one that was behind the door when the explanation was given.
Uh-huh.
Was that this whole notion of a wage? That uh-huh. is the crux of the slave system, of the new improved slave system, the wage.
Uh-huh.
And uh-huh. if you think about it, especially here in well, I mean, it's true in Europe and in, as well as in North America. I remember when I was a very young man, and I was working for a McDonald's franchise as an assistant manager, and I think uh-huh. the minimum wage at the time was, it might have been $3.15 or $3.10. And there was some discussion about the minimum wage being raised to $3.75, and oh, there was so much pushback. You know,
uh-huh.
you know, a 50-cent raise was like, oh man, that's you're just putting these people on the dole, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
Long story short, they raised the minimum wage up to $3.75, right?
Uh-huh.
And the day after the minimum wage went up to $3.75, the owner-operator that I worked for raised all the prices on all the sandwiches, the Big Mac, the Quarter Pounder, the hamburger, the cheeseburger. All the prices
uh-huh.
went up 10, 15 cents per sandwich, right? So
okay.
even though they quote-unquote got a raise,
uh-huh.
because all the prices went up, they were still, relatively speaking, in the same boat.
No doubt.
And that taught me something right then. I'm saying, like, okay, you first of all, you have to twist the arm to get a raise, bend
uh-huh.
over backwards, sweat and labor like a dog, and then when
uh-huh.
they finally do, you know, eke out a measly dime or a quarter, the very
uh-huh.
next thing they do is they raise the prices the same amount that they gave you. So
right.
in terms of actual increased buying power, you don't have any more buying power,
right.
because the prices went
right.
right? And
exactly.
and they call that inflation, right? And
right.
so anyone will tell you, if your annual income is not rising by the cost of inflation per year, as a working person, you're actually going backwards, right?
Yeah, right.
And that's the dilemma that people who are hourly workers find themselves in, that their dollars have less buying power in 2021 than they had in 2000.
Right. Okay.
Because prices have gone ahead faster than wages have risen. So that's a problem in terms of why we are wage slaves, but that doesn't really get at the heart of the matter. So I'm going to take a deep breath, because now we have to talk about the system itself.
Brother Auntie, we got two people holding on.
Couple questions.
So
okay.
let's take those two questions and then head off down your new path. How about that?
Okay.
Greetings. Caller with the last four digits, 3440. Please state your name, where you're calling from, make your comment, or ask your question. Thank you.
Greetings, Sister Q and Brother Auntie. This is Brother Shabaka calling from the Miami, Florida area. I wish you all good evening.
You in Baltimore, brother? How'd you get down to Miami?
Hey, man, it got cool. I decided to come south. Yeah. But whether I'm in Baltimore or Miami, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. I wanted to have you explore a little bit because, you know, coming into certain geographical zones and area, and, you know, they talk about, you know, the cost of living and all that other kind of stuff. And you would, the salary is very, very clear to me because, you know, like yourself, I was a McDonald's assistant manager too, and I've seen exactly what you described. But now I was getting a salary. All right, so what about me when I'm getting a salary? And, you know, I was making a little bit more than the average wage earner. How am I exploited? I mean, I'm a professional. I'm a manager.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. How dare I
explain
that to class of hourly workers? Yeah, I've insulted you. I apologize. The interesting thing, Brother Shabaka, and I used to fall into that same question, was if you think about the difference between the wage is an hourly payout, right? So you work 40 hours a week or 39 and a half hours a week, and you get paid by that. The salary worker, you get a fixed income over a period of time. So, you know, whether it's a week or biweekly or a month, they just say, okay, Shabaka, instead of you being paid $3.50 an hour, we're going to pay you $500 a week. So that's your salary, regardless of how many hours you put in. Am I right? So what many people found out in the salary system, because the assistant manager usually wound up working minimum 50 to 55 hours a week, if not 60. And when you divide your pay into, you know, your 60 hours into what you're getting paid, sometimes the salary worker wasn't making a whole lot more than the guy or the girl who was punching the clock. Sometimes it came out very close, but sometimes it was a little bit better. But the point is that the salary is only a contracted amount, and it's fixed regardless of the number of hours that you work. Now, that becomes important because the salary personnel see themselves in a different category. We see ourselves as, quote, unquote, professional, and on paper we are making more money. But at the end of the day, both the hourly worker and the salaried worker are paid less than the value that they contribute to the end product. What do I mean? Let's take an example I like to use from time to time. We're all involved in the business of making shirts. We're factory workers. We're turning out shirts a day, right? There's 10 of us. We're making $10 an hour. And on average, we make 10 shirts per hour. So at the end of the week, at 40 hours, I'm making $400 a week. Now, Brother Shabaka, you're on salary, so you're making $500 a week, right? But you're putting in more hours than I am, so you're not making a whole lot more than I am, in truth. But we won't go there right now, right? I'm making $400 a week. The 10 of us who are in this place all together, we're walking out of there with $4,000 a week in salary, in wages, right? But we're making what, 500? How many shirts are we making per week? We're making an eight hour day, 10 shirts, 80 shirts per person times 10 of us, that's 800 shirts per day. So at the end of the week, we've turned out, I lost my math here. 5,000.
So, okay.
We're making 5,000 shirts per week. At $20 a shirt, that's the selling price. The company is grossing $100,000 per week based on our work, $100,000 per week, and they're only paying $4,000 per week in salary. Now, let's just say you add the total labor costs, their hourly wage, Chewbacca's salaried amount, the utilities, the raw materials for the fabric and the buttons and the thread, the insurance for operating the business, the overhead, the taxes, the fees. Let's just say all of that comes to $50,000 per week to run it, right? But we're generating $100,000 per week in sales.
Uh-huh.
And the workers who did the work only got paid $4,000 a week. The quote-unquote owners will pocket the $50,000 difference as their profit. That's where the exploitation comes in, and most of us have not been shown that, or we don't understand it. What the owners call profit is really surplus value. In other words, the 10 workers plus Chewbacca as the assistant manager, we generated $100,000 worth of value. It only cost $50,000 that week to run the operation. That $50,000 overage is profit, and the owners claim that for themselves.
Okay.
The truth of the matter is they can't do that because they didn't make it. They did not sweat to make that product. They just sat back and collected the rewards off of our labor. And so then we wonder, how is it that there's such a tremendous income gap? Well, if they're pocketing $50,000 a week and we're walking out of there with just $4,000 a week, that's what? That every week they're walking out of there with $46,000 more than we have. And we are the ones that did the work. No one asked the question, what gives them the right to keep that entire $50,000 profit to themselves? The question should be, how do you look at all of that labor and divide the $50,000 equally among the people who did the work? I'm not saying that the owner shouldn't get something, but they shouldn't walk away with $46,000. And we only left there with $4,000, and we're the ones that did the work, right? And that's where the slavery of it comes into play. That's the exploitation. That's the ripoff.
Okay.
But if, I see some more calls.
Is that satisfactory, Brother Chewbacca? Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's very clear about the surplus value of what the owner would walk away with. I guess it's somewhat similar to, the days, we're talking about COVID, and they had broadcast that Moderna and Pfizer would end up making something like $96 billion in profits, by the end of 2022. So I guess if we really looked at the same similar scenario that you gave, we could see a similar kind of situation. But thank you very much for the response and answer.
Yeah, you're right, Chewbacca. The question really is, who paid for COVID? Who paid for the virus? How did they get paid? Well, the money came out of the treasury, right? Those were tax dollars that citizens in this country paid into the treasury, and they used that money to pay Moderna and Pfizer and Janssen, whatever price they charge. We don't know how much it costs, right? But the point is, the point that you raised, Brother Chewbacca, before we go to the next question, Sister Q, is whatever wealth that is out there can only exist as a result of somebody doing the grunt work. And the problem is the people who are doing the grunt work and producing the surplus value are not at the table to make a decision on how is this surplus value being redistributed back to the people who did the work? That's where we're getting ripped off, and because we don't understand how the system is set up, we think just because we got the paid the $10 an hour that we agreed to work for, that it's a fair system. It is not fair. Mm. It's only fair when we also are able to divide up the surplus as well as the wage or the salary. Let's take another question, Sister Q.
Okay, just a minute. Okay, caller with the last four digits, 4600, your name, please.
Well, I got a couple of questions to ask.
Your name, please?
One, my name is Pianchi. One, Pianchi. Who is the we that he's talking about? And you mean to tell me that all my employees were slaves in their operations that they performed daily?
Yes, precisely. And
I was too.
Here's why that is so. Let's go back to the system of slavery, right?
Yeah.
All of these enslaved Africans, they're working from can't see in the morning to can't see in the evening.
Something they were not unused to doing. But as I said, that it's something they were not unused of doing. But go ahead.
They're producing a product, and they do not receive any benefit of their labor. In other words, their total labor value is stolen by the plantation owner. Would you agree?
Well, not in all cases, because some did receive compensation for what they did. And we don't know how much it was. And also at that time, you know, going back to 1600s, and there's many records and books written on it, this ethnic group you call blacks had Bantu businesses in every industry in this country from 1600 to 1865.
So then what you're saying is that slavery didn't exist in America?
No, I didn't say slavery didn't exist. Slavery existed in the world. Africa taught the world
and
slavery, basically.
The point that we're making is that slavery, I hope you would agree, is an inhumane and an unfair system, because it robs the people who are doing the work.
It depends on
their
society.
The value of the work that they do. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Would you agree that it depends on their society? Let me say something. I had workers that worked for me in skilled trades, commercial construction. We put up, my company built buildings like the ones that fell down in New York during 9/11, bridges and industrial work. It was paid very, very well, to the point that when they retire, their retirement is anywhere from $80,000 to over $100,000 a year. Now, and you had some blacks that worked in that. But here's the thing. In today's climate, in too many of the cases, black children are not being educated correctly. And those that are do receive the awards, and I'm going to give you a demonstration how. I work with an organization.
Hold on, brother, because see where you're going is, you're going to blame the victim. I'm not arguing that
point.
The point I'm making is, if we're going to argue, the workers that you say were well paid, they contributed to the value of your company in excess of what you paid them.
The analogy that you give. Wait a minute, being that I was an owner, hang on for a second. The point we're trying to make tonight, brother,
is surplus value is generated by the workers, and they are not allowed to determine.
I hear what you're saying, but what you're saying is not true, and I'm going to demonstrate to you how it's not true. See, when the project is over, you still got to keep the doors open. You got to keep people. You got to keep a staff. You got to keep workers. You got to keep the maintenance that goes on with the equipment and the warehouse and all those things, although you have no revenue coming in from any projects. So what you call an excess is not really excess. It's just spread out ahead of time. Well, sir, let me finish. Look, you
surplus.
Carry on by yourself. Thank
I
you,
said,
sir. Bye.
Surplus. Surplus. Thank you. See, they always want to come in and turn the capitalist argument into a fair system. The problem with capitalism, the workers are always paid a portion of the surplus value they create. The question is, who controls the surplus? In capitalism, the people who produce the surplus do not control the surplus. That's the problem. And even if it's
what?
Even if it's a black owned company, take over control of the surplus value and you make the decision how much people will get and how much you will keep to run the business. If the system was really fair, the workers sitting down with management would make those decisions collectively. That's why we have to get to cooperatives, because this private control and ownership of the surplus value never works in the benefit of the people who produce the work. That's the essence of an exploiting system. And because it works like that, it has to be violent at some point, because the workers at some point are going to peep the fact that they're being underpaid. Case in point, factory system in Detroit and in the Midwest, United Auto Workers. Those workers went on strike year after contract after contract. They finally got their labor up to like $20 an hour, and they had good benefits, pension, health insurance. The owners looked and said, you know, these workers are getting organized. They're getting more powerful. That's a problem. At the same time, late 1970s, 1980s, we see the advent of the desktop computer. We get robotics into the equation, and the owners hit upon the fact, say, hey, you know what? We're paying these folks $20 an hour. We could set these same factories up in Mexico and pay them like $1.75 an hour and put all that profit in our pocket, and that's what happened in Detroit and Ohio. They shuttered those plants, moved the operation to Mexico, paid those Mexican workers $2 and less an hour, and broke the back of the union in Detroit, turned cities like Detroit and Gary, Indiana, into rust belts, right?
Right.
Idled those workers, left them on the street corners, and so what did you have to do? All of a sudden, here comes crack, because now they're not working. So now, before, where there was a legitimate economy, now we have an underground economy, because the system is designed to keep the owners in control of the surplus value. And anytime it looks like that's getting ready to they're going to lose that control, they bring in the hammer and all the other little machinations to undermine the workers and put people back into even more dire straits. Go ahead, Sister Q.
We have another caller. I'm going to open the line. Caller with the last four digits, 4-5.
I hear you. First off, capitalism's not supposed to be fair. It's supposed to be just. Secondly, if owners are putting in the risk and the capital, they're the ones that hire the workers who agree to that particular salary. Now, if those workers are working under conditions which aren't harmful to them, then they're getting what they've agreed to do. And no, a fair employer does not work and exploit the workers. Let me use your example. I'm going to try to see if I can make an example that's comparable to what you were trying to say. Let's say I'm an owner and I'm making $100,000 a year after taxes. And I got five employees and they make each about $20,000 each after taxes. According to you, since they're making a lot less than me, what we should do is pool together our salaries so that I can take away about $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 from my salary and distribute it amongst the workers. Is that your model?
Is there something wrong with that model? Are you five times better than they are?
Yes.
Are you, as a human being created in the image of God, are you five times better than they are?
In other words, I'm responsible. If you're working for me, am I responsible for your lifestyle?
Oh, Oh, so that gives you the right to exercise that control over their surface.
Answer my question. If you're working
I'm
for me,
your question.
Am I responsible for your lifestyle?
No. That's part of the problem right there. Your attitude suggests that you're better than they are.
Do you want to learn something or do you just want to talk all night? I might teach you something about capitalism.
No, you guys, the capitalists.
Okay,
have,
you just want to keep on talking because you realize
absolutely,
you're talking
because
nonsense
you guys
and you don't want anybody to penetrate that nonsense.
The conversation.
Can I break in here, please?
Then keep quiet
that
I can finish.
Okay.
He hung up.
Here's what's happening, Sister Q. Anytime we have a conversation about the unfairness of capitalism, the capitalists want to jump into the call to legitimize and justify the operation that they have set up, right?
Uh-huh.
But you notice, in order for this system to work, at some point it turns violent because people recognize that they're being exploited and they begin to fight back. That's why we have the police. That's why we have the military, to control the people, the masses of the people, because they always outnumber the owners. He says he's got five people working for him. He's responsible for their livelihoods, and therefore he has to exercise this decision-making power over them. That is not African communalism. That is European capitalism that says this minority of people is superior to everybody else that they have under their control, and it is their God-given duty to make these decisions for the majority. No, that's not even democracy. And you notice that in the workplace, there is no democracy. It's a dictatorship, the dictatorship of the owners. And that's what we are fighting to correct. So, and time is getting away from us, Sister Q. Let's shift very quickly to talking about why cooperatives are the solution to capitalism. Because what we have heard tonight is the argument for private control of the means of production. That's what these gentlemen are arguing for. My company, I'm responsible for these workers' livelihoods. I get to make these decisions. Private ownership of the means of production. Now, it's for those of us that have done any reading in our liberation struggle studies, we know that Amilcar Cabral has said to us, national liberation only exists when the productive forces have been freed from all forms of foreign domination and control. We as working people, as community people, are trying to take control over the means of production because that is what is necessary for us to live meaningful and full lives. We cannot leave our future in the hands of people who only want to exploit us. Now, some owners would get to the point where they say, you know, I know, for example, I worked for Whole Foods for a while, right? And and while you look at the ratio between the owners of a business and the average working person in the business, that gap in many corporations is like 200-300 to 1. In other words, the CEO is walking out of there with a multi-million-dollar package every year, and his highest paid employees might walk out of there with $40,000 or $50,000 a year. And so at Whole Foods they were trying to keep that gap to like no more than 6 to 1. Right? Inside of Us Lifting Us, we're trying to keep that gap in the neighborhood of 4 to 1. So the other thing is in a cooperative, it is the collective group of workers and owners that make the decision about how the wealth will be redistributed. It is not the decision of one person or one small group. It is all of the people together who are producing the work that then make decisions about how the surplus value that they generate will be distributed back to the employees and the community in which the business exists. In other words, we are creating a situation where the means of production are controlled by the people who are doing the work and who live in the communities where these businesses operate. That is what we mean by family-centered collective ownership of these cooperative enterprises. It's the only way we're going to get ourselves to a genuinely democratic society. We cannot have democracy when 1% is walking away with 99% of the wealth. I mean, when Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, when those four or five people make the equivalent of 3.5 billion people on the planet, someone has got to scratch their head and say, something is wrong with that system.
Exactly.
Four people cannot have more wealth than 3.5 of the population of the entire planet. That is exploitation. And it can only exist in a system of extreme violence, both physical violence and mental violence. And because they control the media outlets, the radio, the television, the print media, they get to tell the narrative the way they want to tell it. Oh, I'm this genius employer. I brought the capital to the project, and because I took the greatest risk, therefore I get to control the surplus value. If the workers don't work, there is no surplus value, period.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And the last point that I want to make on that, Sister Q, is this. All of the value on the planet only results from someone doing work. And what I mean by that is this. Think about this. Or take the brother who has the construction company. If the masons don't lay the brick, nothing goes up. I mean, he can be as intelligent and as benevolent as he chooses. If he's not the one down there doing the mud work and putting the bricks in place and raising the building, there's nothing there to have there's nothing to be sold. If the people in McDonald's aren't making the sandwiches, there's no daily sales, there is no profit to be distributed. If the people making the shirts aren't at the sewing machines with the thread and the fabric and the patterns turning out shirts, there is no profit, period. The only time surplus value comes into play is when somebody does work, period. And so the question then comes down to, how do the people doing the work gain control over their surplus value? And that's why you have to have a cooperative enterprise that takes all of the people together. We all sit down together and we make decisions on how this enterprise will operate. That's democracy. Mm-hmm. That's the future that the planet is trying so desperately to bring into place, because the capitalists are doing everything in their power to stay in power. Even when the operations that they're doing are destroying the very environment we all need to breathe and live in, they would rather destroy the environment than share power. Now, that's insanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we find ourselves. Sister Q, I've talked. go ahead.
No, what I was thinking about was when you were talking about the auto workers, that they negotiated up their salaries and benefits and everything. And then the people that own the businesses just got tired of paying them and took the business somewhere else to profit. The auto workers negotiated, if they had created a collective, maybe they would not have made $20 an hour. Maybe they would have. Maybe they would have made more. But the point is, they would have been able to say, no, we're not going to move to Mexico. We're going to figure out what we need to do to work right here. You know,
exactly.
They would have had a say everything after that.
Excellent point.
Yeah.
Well, see, the point that goes along with that, Sister Q, Under capitalism, you have to generate maximum profit. We made
right.
$100,000 last year. We got to make $125,000 next year, right?
Okay.
So there's
mm-hmm.
always this drive to have more and more and more and more. And there's only two places you can get it. You can increase sales, increase productivity, or reduce some of your costs. And
right.
so by
okay.
moving the plants to Mexico, they reduce their costs. Now, they destroyed the cities when they pulled out, but, hey, that's the cost of doing business.
Exactly. And my house, I live in the suburbs, so I wasn't affected, you know, that kind of.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
I don't shop there.
Live
I don't live
the
there.
Suburb.
That has nothing to, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that has nothing
mm-hmm.
to do with
mm-hmm.
me. That's
right,
the attitude.
Right.
Whereas
right.
for if it was a cooperative auto plant, then the people would say, well, we live here. We work here. This is where our families are. So we have to do what we can to maintain all of that.
And see, and you raise another point. When they move the companies to Mexico,
uh-huh.
the lesson that they learned from Detroit in Ohio was if the workers get organized, they're going to drive up their wages, and it's going to cut into our profits. So when
uh-huh.
they move those businesses into Mexico, they also gave money to political parties that promised that they would make sure that there was no union organizing allowed in those districts where those auto plants were located. Do you
wow.
hear what I'm saying?
Okay. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
They, yeah. American businesses begin to influence the politics in those other countries to guarantee that they would not, that the workers would not be able to organize.
Uh-huh.
And so here you see Mexico in shatters because the United States foreign policy is manipulating their politics to keep the environment conducive for them to keep those wages at $2 an hour.
Uh-huh.
Same thing in Haiti.
Okay. Right.
So American workers have been able to make $20 and $25 an hour because the United
uh-huh.
States has reaped super profits from controlling the labor situation in countries abroad. So
yeah.
so 10 million people have died in the Belgian Congo so that the Silicon Valley can get access to coltan to make computer phones
uh-huh.
and they've manipulated the politics in the Congo so that the people can't be really free.
Right. Okay.
Right. So
yeah.
so now we have to have troops all over the world because people are tired of being exploited. So now you've
uh-huh.
got the United States maintaining 800 military bases around the world, quote unquote, making America safe because they're
right.
exploiting the rest of the world so that the American workers can be bribed and make higher pay.
Right.
So it even though you live in the suburbs, you are affected. Your tax dollars are being used. You're supporting a world order that is
uh-huh.
killing millions of people around the globe and destroying
right.
the environment. And all of that now is coming home to roost. And so
uh-huh.
the people who are on the ground at the local level, it now falls to us to say there has got to be another way of organizing our social life together. This system
exactly.
of capitalism simply will not work any longer. And the solution is the cooperative model. Because
so,
in the cooperative, everyone has an equal voice.
So it's almost 10 o'clock, Brother Anki. Give us a quick synopsis on how we would go about joining ULU, which is the cooperative.
Certainly, yes.
That
There's a $50 annual membership fee that goes to defraying setup costs, et cetera. And then each member is encouraged to purchase a co-op unit for $1,000. And 1,000 members putting in $1,000 equals $1 million. With that capital, we begin to open cooperative businesses that each of us collectively own and control. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's very basic, we begin to look at your community, whatever businesses are in your community, ask yourself, how many of these are cooperatives? How many of these do I have an ownership in, and I sit in, at the board and make decisions about how these businesses should run? In my community, there's none. So our challenge is the dry cleaner, the grocery store, the beauty supply shop, the fast food joint, all of those businesses can be run as a cooperative. And that's our goal, create a complex of cooperative businesses that are collectively owned and operated by African folk here in the North America and around the globe that meet and supply the needs of our people, our children, and future generations.
Thank you for that, Brother Anki. We want to thank folks that joined us this evening. We'll be back next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another installment of Dare to Win. And with that, I will say peace.
Peace, sister. Thank you.
Thank you.